Welcome to The Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. Foodie and winophiles, I believe I may have cooked up the perfect show. There's a veritable smorgasbord of new titles being served up just now. I've prepped for the task and researched favorites of critics and readers alike. My guest today, Pulitzer Prize winner Michael Moss, delivers a scorching indictment of America's food giants in his Salt, Sugar, and Fat. It's all ahead on today's menu, so stay tuned as we turn to page one of the book report. In Sous Chef, 24 Hours on the Line, Chef Michael Gibney uses one day to animate the intricate camaraderie and culinary choreography of an upscale New York restaurant kitchen. Readers see exactly what it takes to deliver an exceptional plate of food. Sous Chef offers a fly-on-the-wall perspective on the food service industry, bringing listeners into the hidden world behind kitchen doors in real time. Foodies get a detailed insider's perspective, while fledgling professional cooks get an honest picture of what the future holds. Anthony Bourdain commented that the book was, quote, a terrific nuts and bolts account of the real business of cooking as told from the trenches. No nonsense. This is what it takes. Fred Berman narrates.
He was a tall man, at least 6'3". With a mange of unattended curls atop his head that made him appear even taller. He stood with his back to me, a navy blue pinstriped suit hanging loosely over his broad shoulders. He puffed at a cigarette and chatted on his phone, making lively gestures with his free hand, while a nimbus of smoke collected in the air around him. Even though I couldn't see his face, there was something about his posture that I recognized immediately. He was poised, yet oddly stooped at the same time. His movements were quick and fitful, yet marked by a certain calculated meditative finesse, which could be detected even in something as simple as the way he flicked the ash from his cigarette. And then my eyes fell on his shoes and it hit me. Checker print slip-on tennies, with a suit no less. I knew this man, Chef Marco Pierre White. I lit up another smoke and waited for him to finish his phone conversation so I could say hello. Of course, I didn't actually know the man, I only knew of him. I had read his books and I had seen the hoary BBC clips of him preparing noisette d'agneau avec cervelle de veau en crepinette for Albert Roux while a young Gordon Ramsay traipsed around in the background trying to make his bones. I knew he was the kitchen's original bad boy, the forerunner of our modern restaurant rock stars. I knew that he was the first British chef and the youngest at the time, 33, to earn 3 Michelin stars. And I knew that the culinary world quaked when he decided at age 38 to give them all back and hang up his apron. And I knew that in recent years, he'd made his way back to the stove in one form or another, on television and elsewhere. So while I didn't actually know him, I did know that no matter how gauche it is to descend starstruck upon idols, I couldn't pass up the opportunity to make his acquaintance. At first, I was met with the annoyance and reservation one comes to expect when approaching celebrities on the streets of Manhattan. I assume he thought I knew him from television. But once I announced that I was a fellow chef and mentioned the inspiration I drew as a young cook from his books White Heat and Devil in the Kitchen, he let his guard down and we were able to speak casually. Over the course of 5 or 10 minutes, we talked about the craft of cooking, its values and its drawbacks, and what pursuing it professionally does to the body and mind. Eventually, he had to get going, and I had to return to work as well. I concluded the conversation by asking him how he felt about quitting the industry. He paused dramatically and pulled on his smoke. No matter how much time you spend away from the kitchen, he said, cooking will always keep calling you back. We pitched our butts and parted ways. I was 16 years old when I started working in restaurants. I managed to land a job washing pots in an Irish pub owned by a high school friend's father. More than 13 years have passed since I made the decision. In that time, I've seen all manner of operation, big and small, beautiful and ugly. I've climbed the ladder from dishwasher to chef and cooked all the stations in between. The experiences I've had along the way have been some of the best ever and some of the worst imaginable. What follows is my attempt to distill these experiences into a manageable, readable form. A day in the life, as I've seen it.
We've just heard Sous Chef, 24 Hours on the Line, by Michael Gibney. Michael Moss was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for explanatory reporting in 2010. He was also a finalist for the prize in 2006 and 1999. Before coming to the New York Times, he was a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, Newsday, and the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Michael's book, Sugar, Salt, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us, has been a phenomenal bestseller, and it's now available in paperback. Welcome, Michael, and thanks for joining us on the Book Report.
Great to talk to you.
Your book has so many facts that just make your hair stand on edge. For example, a cup of Yoplait has as much sugar as a bowl of Lucky Charms.
You have to realize that one of the things that concerns nutritionists is not just that the food companies have engineers on staff, food chemists, who perfect the perfect amounts of sugar, which they call the bliss point, in things like ice cream and soda, but they've marched around the grocery store adding sugar to products that didn't used to be sweet before, so that now bread has added sugar and a bliss point that'll send us over the moon. Yogurt, as you mentioned, can have as much sugar in it as ice cream. Pasta sauces can have the equivalent of a couple of Oreo cookies worth of sugar in a tiny half-cup serving. And what this does is teaches us to expect sweetness in everything we eat. Kids are especially hardwired for the sweet taste. So when you drag their little bodies over to the produce aisle and try to get them to eat more Brussels sprouts and broccoli, which every nutritionist says we should be doing, they're going to get those bitter notes. Forget about it.
Right. You say in the book that Americans consume 71 pounds of caloric sweeteners each year, or 22 teaspoons of sugar per person per day. So if you're switching to sugar-free soda, for example, does that have any kind of an impact?
Maybe, maybe not. I mean, there's some sense that diet sodas especially haven't been the silver bullet for dieting that people were hoping there were, because if you tinker with just one of these three things, salt, sugar, and fat, you're going to, you know, you're not dealing with the whole picture. And there's also some sense, too, that people will have a diet soda and then think it's prophylactic against calories, and they'll have an extra cookie or a muffin, and that frankly will wipe out what other gain you're doing from that. So, you know, dieting is complicated.
What about low-fat products?
You know, I'm starting to come around to the notion that the whole low-fat focus has also played right into the hands of the processed food industry, that it may actually be smarter to go with a whole fat yogurt, for example, if you can limit the amount that you're doing. Yes, you're getting more saturated fat, but you're also getting more satisfaction or satiety. It's going to fill you up more. And the dangerous low fat is that you replace the fat with sugar. And the smartest nutritionists and experts out there are now saying that that's a really bad trade-off. You're much better off getting the fat.
Hmm. You know, the book alludes to the fact that there's a close connection between the food giants and big tobacco. Can you talk a little about that?
In a really surprising way, and this is one of the reasons why the research and reporting for this book for me was like being inside a detective story, the largest tobacco company of all, Philip Morris, became the largest food company in North America when it bought the old General Foods Company and then Kraft in the 80s. And for the 80s and the 90s, and I was privy to the internal documents, you can see the tobacco managers doing what you would expect them to do. They're nudging and cajoling and sometimes lending some of their own marketing schemes to their food company, to the food executives, to get them to sell more product. But starting in the late 90s, Philip Morris breaks with the tobacco industry, becomes the first company to embrace government regulation. And when it does, of tobacco, and when it does that, the tobacco managers turn privately to their food executives and warn them that they are going to have as much trouble, if not more, on salt, sugar, fat, obesity as the tobacco executives were already having with nicotine, cigarettes, and that they're going to have to do something to lessen their dependence on what I call the holy trinity of the processed food industry, salt, sugar, fat.
Hmm. Do you believe our government is doing any watchdogging of the food industry?
Really taken aback by how the government regulators who are supposed to be there watching over the companies for us are in many ways less powerful than the companies themselves, and quite often they're working together. I tell the story about cheese and how the USDA came up with a marketing plan that helped the dairy industry turn cheese into not something you eat for itself or in a sandwich, but into an additive. So now you go to the dairy aisle and it's filled with bags that are stuffed with cheese that's shredded, diced, cubed, tubbed, much of it processed cheese, all to get us to use more cheese as an additive to ingredients. Bottom line, our consumption of cheese has tripled since the 70s to an average of 33 pounds per person per year.
Ugh. Michael, I think your book should be required reading for med students. Do you think that medical schools are doing enough to spread the word about better nutrition?
You know, it's really, medical schools, yes, to some extent. I mean, nutritionists know. And they all say that, look, we should be eating twice as many vegetables and whole fruits that we are now for better health. The real key, I think, has to start younger in grammar school. I write about the demise of the home economic system in this country, where girls and to some extent boys were taught how to shop, how to cook, how to be mindful of food. I don't think we can go back to that. But I'm noticing that even kids are reading the book because they're really jazzed by food in the context of politics and the sort of situation of these multinational corporations shaping our eating habits. And that is really attractive to kids. And I think that you can talk to them and engage them in a conversation about food through the politics of food.
Now, you highlight some examples of companies trying to make their food healthier. Are there any changes you see as truly positive?
Yeah, I think you're starting to see some edging. And again, you know, since the book came out a year ago in hardcover, and it just came out in paper now, the companies have been under increasing pressure to improve the health profile of their products. They're really good at cutting back on one of the three, salt, sugar, or fat, and often what they do is increase the other two. But now they're looking at sort of total calories, and it's a real open question still whether they can really do it. Their food scientists are convinced that if they try hard enough, they can. But after a while, if you really whack back at the salt and the sugar and the fat all together in many of these products, you have to ask, really, what's left?
Mm. Okay, I'm so interested to know what you're setting your sights on for your next investigation.
You know, I'm actually going to do another book for Random House that looks more deeply at this question of food and free will and addiction. I've used the A word very sparingly, and I'm going into the world of science to see just what we know about that and how relevant the A word can be for treatment programs and sort of what some of the alternatives that have been, you know, fobbed upon us as silver bullets in response to food, and especially these hyper-engineered products.
Michael, what can shoppers do when they walk into a grocery store? You allude to some shopping lists.
So the first thing to realize is that when you walk in the door, the supermarket, the retailer, and the manufacturers are doing everything they can to get you to make an impulsive, spontaneous decision. That's why supermarkets are like this la-la land of soft music and bright neon colors and strategic positioning, where the food manufacturers pay extra to position those products in the most visible parts of the store. So first thing to combat that and to sort of get in and out with your good health, make a list, do your best to stick with it because they're trying to get you off of that shopping list. Work the outer perimeter of the store. That's where the produce is and the less processed meats and dairy. Be careful throughout the inner part of the store in the middle parts of the aisle at eye level, because the companies do experiments where they've put devices on people's heads that measure their eye movements, and they know that when we step into the aisle, our attention goes to the eye level middle part of the aisle. That's where the most sugary products are, for example, in the cereal aisle. So if you're looking for a plain Cheerios or plain oatmeal, you're typically going to have to look low on the ground or reach way up high. And lastly, the checkout counter, be really careful that you're standing in line. They're starting to put coolers of soda there to just tempt you to reach in and take that as well.
I personally read the trash magazines while I'm waiting.
Hey, that's totally safe.
Okay.
Right? No calories in that.
What about, the, quote, organic or natural food aisle?
I think that, and again, you know, nutritionists are telling me, scientists, look, if you can afford it, chances are with organic, you're going to get somewhat lower profiles of pesticides. That's what they're about. But you have to remember that just the word organic on a product can mean that it's just as loaded with calories, with fat, with salt and sugar as a non-organic product. So it's become sort of part of this front of the label health washing touting that goes on to basically put us at ease and keep us from looking at the fine print on the back of the package.
So read the labels once and always.
Right.
Well, Michael, I think your book is required reading for anyone who spends a dime in a grocery store. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. For a preview of Salt, Sugar, Fat, check bookreportradio.com, archived shows, week of February 16th, 2013. For foodies or trivia junkies looking for some delicious light fare, lobsters scream when you boil them, entertains while it informs. And honestly, don't you just love the title? The book clears the air on facts and tips people spout off when talking about food, using cooking science, chemistry, and tested methods to dispel myths. Bruce Weinstein and Mark Scarborough offer up "Lobsters Scream When You Boil Them" and 100 other myths about food and cooking. So, is the 5-second rule for real? Will eating carrots improve your eyesight? Is your cookware a health hazard? Do spicy foods cool you down? No, 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 and no. In this entertaining and informative reference guide, award-winning cookbook authors take on more than 100 popular kitchen myths and dish up answers to all your burning questions. Whether you're a serious foodie, an avid dieter, a trivia lover, or just searching for the secret to the perfect cup of coffee, this fun title, narrated by John McLean, is essential countertop reading.
Bruce and I have had a set plan for writing our previous 20 books. We dream up the recipes together. He goes into the kitchen. We taste them. We argue. Some are perfect. Some go back to the drawing board. And I eventually write the book. This one's different. We wrote it together. He ensconced himself in an overstuffed chair beside my desk, and we went at it. But the idea for the book started with a phone call.
What's the thing about the butter?
My mother and I dispensed with hello years ago. For people whose progenitors fell during the Siege of Chattanooga, we're downright gruff, like New Yorkers with heirloom silver. The butter? I sighed.
I'm baking cookies.
Are you using one of our recipes? She's a diminutive southerner who's never cooked one of the more than 10,000 recipes Bruce and I have developed.
You know I love you, dear.
I didn't take the bait. Mother, we've been over this butter thing before.
I know, but what's the good of having a son go to grad school, marry a prominent executive, get divorced, come out, move to New York, write screenplays, marry a chef, and do cookbooks with him, all if I have to remember this stuff? Can I just call you up?
At 8:30 in the morning?
You're so busy.
I live in rural New England.
Let me have my imagination. So, the butter?
Cool. Almost right out of the fridge.
Not room temperature? she asked. Are you sure? My cookbook says room temperature. When was it published? Don't get sarcastic. I warned you this would happen if you went to a liberal arts college.
The butter has to be cool to trap air and make a better batter. Preferably just moments out of the fridge.
Now, that wasn't so hard, was it?
Easy for her to say. Like the rest of us, she's surrounded by culinary rip-snorters. We read them in magazines, hear them on cooking shows. Who can keep the facts straight? Eggs raise your cholesterol. Gas stoves are superior to electric. Your tongue has four kinds of taste buds. They seem benign, right? What could it matter if people think that sugar makes them hyper or that margarine is better for them than butter? It matters because these whoppers warp recipes. Here's a head note we recently found. These cookies are better for your kids because they have almost no sugar. You're saving yourself hours of screaming and running around the house. Too bad the cookies are also tasteless. You're clearly saving yourself the trouble of eating them, too. Some myths get passed off as down-from-the-mount truths, like never salt steaks before you cook them. But then you miss the best part, the caramelized sugars extracted from the surface of the beef over the heat by the dehydrating action of the salt, all to give that steak an irresistible, sweet, salty, savory crunch on the outside, even when the meat's rare inside. Other myths aren't just wrong-headed. They lead to kitchen failures, like peanut oil is tasteless. Then someone has a craving for sweets, has no other oil in the house, substitutes peanut oil willy-nilly for the fat in a recipe of white chocolate brownies, and ends up with a big pan of blech. Not many of these doozies are outright lies. Almost all are based on a half-stated fact or a small misunderstanding that got larded up over the years. Turkey makes you sleepy. Spicy foods cool you down. A box of baking soda in the refrigerator absorbs odors. No, no, and no. We'll delve into the whys and wherefores that debunk 101 of the most common kitchen myths, so you can get it right every time. If you want more research, footnotes, scholarly articles and such, we've got a full list of links to them on our website, www.realfoodhascurves.com. Mom, are you reading? Of course not.
That was Lobsters Scream When You Boil Them by Bruce Weinstein and Mark Scarborough. No Experience Necessary is Chef Norman Van Aken's joyride of a memoir. In it, he spans 20-plus years and nearly as many jobs, including the fateful job advert in the local paper for a short-order cook with No Experience Necessary. Long considered a culinary renegade, Van Aken is an American original who chopped and charred, sweated and seared his way to cooking stardom with no formal training, but with extra helpings of energy, creativity, and faith. After landing on the deceptively breezy shores of Key West, Van Aken faced hurricanes, economic downturns, and mercurial money men during the decades when a restaurant could open and close faster than you could type haute cuisine. Van Aken, who narrates the work, is a founder of the Mango Gang, one of the group of pioneers who cooked up Floribian cuisine and helped transform the American culinary landscape. Readers, I can tell you from personal dining experience, Van Aken is a superstar, and this is one tasty title.
I had just returned to Illinois after almost 10 years of cooking in Key West. I told him, "No, we don't need anyone." And I thought, poor kid. So scrawny. Someone should just feed him. But our sous chef nagged me for a few days. We could use him making salads. So it began. Years passed and Charlie showed first Chicago and then America what he could do. My scrawny little brother was tearing up the rule book. Charlie had gotten to know Emeril a year or two before I did. Em was the chef at Commander's Palace in New Orleans, and Charlie had gone down to do an event with him. I remember Charlie calling me on the phone in Miami Beach, where I was chef of a mano at the old Betsy Ross Hotel on Ocean Drive, and telling me that we all needed to get together. He told me that I would fall in love with Emeril. So will Janet, my wife. You two are going to be like brothers. This guy's great. He's got this psycho killer red Porsche, straight out of a Hunter Thompson collection, and he took me all around the Big Easy. He owns that town. He's going to open up his own place like any minute. And so that began too. We got nicknamed the Triangle for our geographical locations on the grid of the American map. We were also connected by the same sense of passion that athletes and musicians feel. And now in this kitchen, with 350 folks, plus Julia Child, waiting for our food, was the part when it's still quiet and your adrenaline is flowing and you are ready to rock and roll. And it was then that the well-dressed maitre d' gave us the signal. Fire first plates! We jumped into the river of no return. Over 700 shrimp that we had peeled that morning and marinated that afternoon hit three blazing hot grills. Emeril made some last-minute adjustments to his huge cauldron of rice. He raced over to Charlie and me and lifted up two tasting spoons brimming and steaming to our lips. Orgasmic, lethal, righteous. When he saw our faces, he broke into a huge grin. He looked like the kid who hit the winning home run at the Little League World Series and was now rounding the bases, waving his cap to the crowd. 30 chefs were lined up at two long plating tables. Emeril and I made one sample dish for each group to show the other chefs the way we wanted our food plated. The assembly line went into gear, steadily gaining momentum until we were ready to hand the servers two plates each, no trays, to take to the grand dining room past the ice machines, down a long hall with gathering speed and hell-bent for leather determination. The Delta crayfish with red beans and rice cake was at the perfect temperature now. The shrimp with chorizo perched just so on top sent out its hot and smoky perfume. The plates were given a last-second swipe with a hot cloth by our wives at the far end of each line. Either they or we personally inspected the assembled chef's efforts and then and only then allowed the plates to go out. We had about 30 dishes ready and moving out to the hall when the tuxedoed dandy came running from the dining room and screeched, "Stop! Stop! Stop! They are not ready! Another speech has begun!" Emeril was on him first. "What are you saying? You said to fire the food and it is fired, man!" 30 chefs froze in horror. Everyone understood the gravity of the situation. Our shrimp would be overcooked. Our rice cakes would be cold. And Julia Child was out there in that dining room. The feeling was nauseating, and I almost couldn't take it. The espresso churned in my guts and sloshed around my heart. Charlie dashed over to us, and we huddled quickly. We were agreed. Emeril and I marched back to the top of the plating lines. You could have heard a sprig of parsley fall. Jim Morrison, in his whiskey-a-go-go prime, couldn't have screamed any louder or looked any more possessed than Charlie did at that moment. The maitre d' was nearly knocked down by the servers rushing the hot plates past him into the banquet hall and on to Miss Child's table first. Over the next 2.5 hours, we sent out the remaining 6 courses. 350 guests. That's a lot of china. The kitchen is often described as being a place that takes on a balletic grace, a place where a disparate group of human beings become a fluid dynamic of precision and perfect accord. And if the chef chooses to change a garnish at the last second, each chef de partie would see that and immediately conform to the new way of doing things.
We've just heard No Experience Necessary by Norman Van Aken. From Scratch chronicles the big personalities, high drama, and behind-the-scenes story of the Food Network. Alan Salkin spotlights the business, media, and cultural juggernaut that changed the way America thinks about food. In October 1993, a tiny startup called the Food Network debuted to little notice. 20 years later, it is a welcome visitor in 100 million homes, approaches $1 billion a year in revenue, and has produced a galaxy of stars. Based on extensive inside access, documents, interviews with hundreds of executives, stars, and employees up and down the ladder, Salkin's book is a roller coaster ride from chaos to conquest. As Salkin takes us inside conference rooms, studios, homes, restaurants, and after-hour meetings, we see a salty Julia Child lording it over the early network performers, a fragile Emeril Lagasse staggering from the sudden public shock of cancellation, a very green Rachel Ray nearly burning down her set on her first day, and a determined Bobby Flay reinventing himself to survive. Paula Deen, Anthony Bourdain, Mario Batali, Jamie Oliver, Martha Stewart, Guy Fieri, and more. Salkin illuminates people we thought we knew and the ones we never knew about in this irresistible intersection between business, TV, pop culture, and food. Julian Fleischer narrates.
There was no Food Network to overcome the lack of food knowledge in my house. On TV, I watched cartoons after school or, when we got cable, old movies. I certainly would have watched Food Network, though I can't tell you why I was starved for such knowledge. A yearning for something authentic and true in an era when the noisy ideals of a previous generation were hitting a wall? A world where the government proposed ketchup as a vegetable for school lunches? I don't know why I was hungry, but I was. We all were, it turned out. When I went to UC Berkeley and was surrounded by the flourishing food culture of the late 1980s, within a year, I was perfecting my guacamole and baking my own bread. By 1996, around 31,000 people over the age of 18 were watching Food Network, the term used by those who work there. Outsiders call it the Food Network. And about a third of those viewers were from households with children. In New Hyde Park, New York, a shy teenager named Todd Mitgang was watching. His mother never used any green but iceberg lettuce, and every meat was prepared the same way. A shake of salt, a shake of garlic powder, and under the broiler. The best restaurant he had ever been to was a Benihana. He ordered Rocky's Choice. The stir fry was a revolution to him. It combined steak and chicken. Over the next few years, he watched Food Network after school and was spellbound as Sarah Moulton demonstrated knife skills on cooking live. Mario Batali cooked with fresh garlic, and Emeril threw something spicy on meat and exclaimed, "Bam!" Fast forward to 2012, when Todd opened Crave Fish Bar, a seafood restaurant in Manhattan. A reviewer wrote, "Mitgang slices scallops thin and douses them in enough curry oil to heat up Manitoba. He adds sliced heirloom cherry tomatoes to black bass sashimi for the right amount of zing. Then he ups the ante with king salmon that's cut as thick as corn-fed ribeye. Roll over, Benihana. Tell McDonald's the news." Somehow, Food Network captured an audience that did not know that it wanted 24 hours a day of food television. Then, having roped in the early adopters, the network figured out how to create an even bigger audience. Food Network is not single-handedly responsible for the food revolution, but it took what was happening in some food-forward pockets of the world, including, fortuitously, those within a 3-mile radius of its Manhattan headquarters, and delivered it to everybody. It made converts, and yes, sometimes in its greed and ambition, it perverted the message along the way. Then it kept pulling out a divining rod to learn what fresh pockets had formed and honed the message to fit the new reality it had helped create. For this book, I interviewed nearly everyone you will meet here, and many you won't. Stars, executives, makeup artists, drivers, agents, producers, web developers, prep cooks, and many others. I read original documents, strategic plans, research reports, old marketing pamphlets, press releases, and news articles.
That was From Scratch, Inside the Food Network by Alan Salkin. Provence 1970 is about a singular historic moment. In the winter of that fateful year, more or less coincidentally, iconic culinary figures James Beard, MFK Fisher, Julia Child, Richard Olney, Simone Beck, and Judith Jones found themselves together in the south of France. They cooked and ate, talked and argued about the future of food in America, the meaning of taste, and the limits of snobbery. Without quite realizing it, they were shaping today's tastes and culture, the way we eat now. The conversations among this group were chronicled by MFK Fisher in journals and letters, some of which were later discovered by Luc Barr, her great-nephew. In Provence, 1970, Barr captures this seminal season and peppers it with gossip, drama, and contemporary relevance. Alex Prudhomme, co-author of Julia Child's My Life in France, comments, "Luc Barr paints an intimate portrait of the ambitious, quarrelsome, funny, hungry pioneers who brought about a great culinary shift, the ending of the classical era and the beginning of a newly experimental, wide-ranging, ambitious cuisine, one that was inspired by France but was quintessentially American in style and flavor. Provence, 1970, gives a front-row seat to the creation of modern American cooking." John Rubenstein narrates.
"Even more than the drumsticks, though, I remember my dawning sense of mortification as I heard myself say, 'This is exactly the same thing we had the last time we were here.' The adults all laughed awkwardly. Needless to say, I hadn't meant the remark as any kind of criticism, but that's what they all thought, I realized too late. That I was suggesting she had a limited cooking repertoire. MF assured me she had made the dish again, especially for me, since I'd liked it so much the last time we were there, which must have been months earlier. We visited 3 or 4 times a year. I quickly agreed that I had, and still did. Everyone watched me as I ate. I ate slowly at that age. This was another topic for discussion. 'Luc, you are a very slow eater,' MF said, not for the first time. She approved of this character trait. 'One should stop and savor the food while eating, take pleasure in the moment.' She, too, was a slow eater. MF spoke to children as if they were slightly amusing adults. She took them seriously, though, I remember. Her voice was quiet and confiding. She looked me right in the eyes and listened when I spoke, and in her eyes I saw an impossible combination of intense interest and dispassionate, calculating judgment. There was no condescension at all, but she left no doubt that she was at all times taking note of what you said and how you said it, what you ate, and how quickly. That look in her eyes is my most lasting memory of my great aunt." The adults drank wine. Wine with lunch was something that happened only up north in Sonoma County, at Last House and at Nora's in Jenner. The lunches were correspondingly longer, leisurely hours spent around the table cracking crab and passing the salad and opening more wine. And there was dessert, an unusual and welcome luxury for a 10-year-old at lunchtime. After we cleared the table, MF served vanilla ice cream with baked nectarines. The nectarines weren't hot, they were warm, and the same had been true of the drumsticks. MF always finished cooking long before her guests arrived and then pulled dishes out of the cooling oven as needed or left them on the counter. There was never a hint of effort or any last-minute flurry of activity. "Did you bring your swimsuits?" MF asked after lunch. We had. In Jenner, we would go to Goat Rock Beach and wade in the surf, ice cold even in summertime, or swim in the Russian River in nearby Gurneville. But at Last House, there was a pool. It was just up the hill, behind the main house, which belonged to MF's friend, David Pleydell Bouverie. Bouverie was a debonair and idiosyncratic Englishman, an expat aristocrat, grandson of the 5th Earl of Radnor, a title dating back to the 18th century. He had come to America as a young man in the early 1930s and eventually married Alice Astor, the heiress. They divorced after a few years in 1952, and Bouverie went on to the life of a jet-setting bon vivant. He settled in Glen Ellen and built an estate suitable for the sort of grand entertaining he undertook, hosting dinners that mixed local characters, San Francisco socialites, and European royalty. The rooms were filled with art, paintings by Matthias Witos and John Singer Sargent, among others, and dramatic pieces of overscale furniture. Trained as an architect, Bouverie had designed all the various buildings on his ranch, including a bell tower, a barn, and guest houses.
We've just heard Provence, 1970, by Luc Barr. And now I'm serving up some fun fiction, shall we say, as an amuse-bouche. Roast Mortem is number 9 in the popular Coffee House Mystery Series by Cleo Coyle. When the firefighters of Ladder Company 189 pull Claire's friends out of a blazing cafe, she happily comes to their rescue. As a favor to the guys, she visits their firehouse kitchen to teach them the finer points of operating their newly donated espresso machine. But more than their coffee turns out to be hot, somebody's torching cafes around the city, and firefighters are beginning to die in suspicious ways. Believing the two events are related, Claire investigates, staking out a 5-borough bake sale and sniffing out clues in some of Brooklyn's pizza joints. When her detective boyfriend, Mike Quinn, is pulled into the fire of a false accusation, Claire knows she must put out the flames. But will she be able to come to Mike's rescue before someone tries to extinguish her? Rebecca Gibel narrates.
Boss, I hate to leave you like this, but I have got to go. Go, I told Esther. We'll be okay. At least I hoped we would. I was standing behind my espresso machine, facing a line out my door. The usual Village Blend regulars were here, along with a swell of caffeine-deprived commuters grabbing a Java hit before heading home. Nothing out of the ordinary, really, and in most respects, the day felt like any other. Except it wasn't. This was the day the fires began. When the smoke finally cleared, the fatalities would number 2, and they would not be accidents. The deaths would turn out to be murders, and I, Claire Cozy, would be the one to prove it. At this particular moment, however, I wasn't thinking about killers or arsonists, lovesick Italian women or blustery FDNY captains, and I certainly wasn't thinking about a bomb. Mostly what I was thinking about was traffic. Tucker Burton, my lanky, floppy-haired assistant manager, had arrived on time for his shift and was just tying on his Village Blend apron. A part-time actor, playwright, and occasional cabaret director, Tucker loved being a barista in the Italian tradition, which, like a good bartender, had as much to do with convivial customer interaction as it did with temperature and pressure. "Excuse me, Claire," he said, "but where is Gardner again?" "Trapped in his car," I replied, "on the New Jersey side of the Holland Tunnel." Tuck pointed to Esther. "And why can't our resident slam poetess stay and work another hour until he shows? I'll bet my actor's equity card she's been late to more than a few of her classes." Esther's wine-dark fingertips went to her Botticelli waist. "Excuse me, Broadway boy, but I am not simply taking this class. I am a TA and need to be there on time."
"For what? Introduction to Baggy Pants and Bling 101?
Urban rap's influence on mainstream America?"
"Who's the professor? Eminem?"
Esther smirked. "The man has a PhD from Brown in linguistics and is heading my program in the semiotics of urban expression."
"Yeah, and I know what seat he holds, the Snoop Dogg chair."
"Okay, you two, enough." I turned to Tucker. "Let her off the hook."
That was Roast Mortem by Cleo Coyle. Nothing goes better with a feast, even this literary one, than some wine. Edward Humes, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, tells the story of the self-made billionaire who built the Kendall Jackson Empire in A Man and His Mountain, the everyman who created Kendall Jackson and became America's greatest wine entrepreneur. Jess Stone Street Jackson was one of a small band of pioneering entrepreneurs who put California's wine country on the map. His life story is a compelling slice of history, daring, innovation, feuds, intrigue, talent, mystique, and luck. offering a unique window on the adventurous, cutthroat worlds of Jackson's two passions, wine and horse racing. Time after time, his decisions would be ignored and derided, then envied and imitated as the world watched him become a billionaire. Mel Foster narrates.
Corporate scions and other assorted rich guys were always showing up in horse country, and wine country for that matter, certain their mad business skills would set them apart. The old guard with the blue grass and blue blood found it highly entertaining because the newcomers invariably skulked away with egos and wallets deflated. And yet here, infuriatingly, was Jess Jackson, transforming a staid and insular thoroughbred industry against its will, as he had previously done in the wine business. He flouted convention. He denounced the corruption others pretended not to see. Worse, he was not just a California winemaking interloper. He was, of all things, a lawyer, too, and he would never be forgiven by the old guard for suing the pants off famous, and thanks to Jackson, infamous, horsemen for cheating him. Hence, the death threats that prompted the bodyguard, along with backroom attempts to block him from entering this marquee race. The obstructionists failed in the end, although Jackson's horse was stuck in the absolute worst starting position possible, a handicap no other horse had ever overcome. But this time, the horse was Rachel Alexandra, a 3-year-old filly in the midst of one of the great racing campaigns in the history of the sport. Her previous race, just 2 weeks before, the Kentucky Oaks, had set her apart. That race, a $500,000 contest at Churchill Downs for 3-year-old fillies, held on the day before the Kentucky Derby, had stunned racing fans as Rachel won by more than 20 lengths, by far the largest margin of victory in the history of that race. Jackson had been a spectator, not an owner, for that one, but after he saw Rachel run, he had to have her. He was one of the 400 richest men in the world at that point, and no price was really beyond him, a thought that, after so many years, still startled him when he took the time to reflect on it, still etched his broad face, not with pride, but with something that looked very much like discomfort. He had never lost the poor kid's unease at spending, the idea that thriftiness, not lavishness, was the thing to be admired. This was a guy who still wore his grandfather's hand-me-down boots, after all. "Plenty of wear left in them," he'd grouse when someone asked him about the broken-down old things. So for a long time, he wouldn't say how much he had paid for Rachel, pretending it was a secret deal of some sort, when in fact he was simply embarrassed. When he finally admitted the price tag had been $10 million, he looked sheepish, but confessed no regrets. "She was," he would say in a tremulous tone, as if he were explaining how he had come to possess the Mona Lisa or achieve the summit at Everest, "worth every penny." And to him, Rachel was his latest Mona Lisa, and the campaign he had designed for her was his latest mountaintop. Her previous owner had not planned to enter the Preakness. He didn't believe in running females against stallions, which was a prevailing view among the racing elite. But Jackson had immediately announced his intention to enter the race, notwithstanding the tumult brought on by a new stable, a new trainer, a new jockey, and almost no time left to prepare. The other owners predicted disaster. No way could Jackson prep her in time, and even if he did, there was no way a 3-year-old filly, no matter how talented and successful against other females, could stand up to a field of stallions in one of the biggest races in the world. Didn't this outsider, this meddler, understand anything about thoroughbreds? He wasn't just going against tradition, he was going against nature. A filly hadn't won this race since before the Great Depression, with good reason. It lay in the female horse's genes, her most ancient instinct, the cardinal rule of the herd, to back down when challenged by a male.
That was A Man in His Mountain by Edward Humes.
The Juice Vinus Veritas is a new collection by Jay McInerney, the popular novelist who brought us Bright Lights, Big City. For more than a decade, McInerney's wine-centered essays, now featured in the Wall Street Journal, have been praised by restaurateurs, culinary critics, and the media. In fact, the New York Times had this to say about McInerney. His wine judgments are sound, his anecdotes witty, and his literary references impeccable. That's heady stuff. In The Juice, McInerney, who performs the book, provides a masterclass in the almost infinite varieties of wine and the people and places that produce it the world over, from the historic past to the often confusing present. He takes us to such legendary chateaus as Margaux and Latour, then to Australia, New Zealand, and South Africa, and on to new contenders in Santa Rita Hills and Paso Robles. Conspicuous throughout is McInerney's trademark flair and expertise, which, in 2006, prompted the James Beard Foundation to grant him the MFK Fisher Distinguished Writing Award.
Granted, there was some context here. My best friend, Gary Fiskachon, a junior editor at Random House, had reviewed a chapbook by Carver for the Village Voice, and, through his legendary champion, Gordon Lish, had gotten to know him. He would later become Carver's editor, as well as my own. Some years before, when we were at Williams College, I lent Gary a book called Will You Please Be Quiet, Please, and since then, we had both been passionate Carver fans. Now, Gary was returning the favor with interest. They had lunch together, and Carver had nothing to do until his reading at Columbia that evening, so Gary volunteered my services as a tour guide for the afternoon, assuming that I would be thrilled. Which I was, despite an apocalyptic headache. The buzzer rang, an indistinct mumble came through the intercom, and then the doorway was filled by this hulking, slouching bear whom I ushered into a tiny Greenwich Village apartment that showed all the signs of an arduous, recently terminated binge. We never got around to touring the city and instead talked for 4 or 5 hours, mostly about writing, until it was well past time to get Carver to his reading. At some point, he said, almost apologetically, "I don't know, the life you're living here doesn't seem exactly conducive to writing." While it didn't take a master storyteller to make this observation, from him it sounded like an epiphany. Carver knew whereof he spoke, a devotee of Alcoholics Anonymous who credited that organization with saving his life. 6 months later, I moved to Syracuse to study with Ray and clean up my act. Having heard nutritionists distinguish between good fats and bad fats, I would propose a similar dichotomy for intoxicants. Certainly this was the opinion of Thomas Jefferson, the nation's first wine geek. "No nation is drunken where wine is cheap," he declared, "and none sober where the dearness of wine substitutes ardent spirits as the common beverage. It is, in truth, the only antidote to the bane of whiskey." Or vodka, I might add. One can't help but wonder how different Russia's history might have been if the country was warm enough for viticulture. "Wine is one of the most civilized things in the world," Hemingway wrote in Death in the Afternoon, "and one of the natural things of the world that has been brought to the greatest perfection. And it offers a greater range for enjoyment and appreciation than possibly any other purely sensory thing." Not his greatest prose, perhaps, and like so many encomiums to wine, the Ernest Jefferson's springs to mind, it leaves out the buzz factor. They don't, for example, call them winos for nothing. Still, it impressed me at the time, especially since I'd discovered that the bane of whiskey and the road of excess hadn't led me to any palaces at all. But Syracuse was leading me in far more rewarding directions, in large part thanks to Ray and Tobias Wolff demonstrating how to advance from apprenticeship into actual writing. To supplement my fellowship, tuition plus $4,000 a year, I worked as a clerk in the Westcott Cordial Shop, whose Princeton-educated proprietor had an extensive wine library and high hopes for the Scabrous neighborhood's eventual gentrification. Here I could oscillate between the stories of Isaac Bobble and Hugh Johnson's World Atlas of Wine, dip into the stock after finishing my shift, and gradually refine my rudimentary palate. This is also where I got the call, some 2 years on, that my novel had been bought by Random House, and a subsequent one from a guy who kept calling me Babe and wanted to fly me out to Hollywood to meet with his fellow executives at Paramount. "We'll put you up at the Chateau Marmont," he said. "Is that good?" I asked. "It's better than good," he assured me. "John Belushi died there." Clearly, he'd read Bright Lights Big City, or at least the coverage of the book, and formed an opinion of my bad habits.
That was The Juice by Jay McInerney. Readers, I hope you've enjoyed the many courses served up today. Food and Wine, The Romance of It All, and The Big Business Behind the Illusion. Sometimes good, sometimes rotten to the core. For more literary fare, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks for joining me, and please reserve your table for 1 week for the next edition of The Book Report.